As the fall hunting deer seasons approach, the state DNR has an update on how Wisconsin is containing chronic wasting disease. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. CWD is a contagious and deadly neurological disease, and the Department of Natural Resources has ordered hunters in six northwestern townships to submit deer they kill this fall for CWD tests. And a deer baiting and feeding ban is now in effect for Barron, Burnett, Polk, and Washburn counties. Do you hunt deer? What questions do you have about CWD regulations? We're at 800-642-1234. Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter in Superior. Danny, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So the DNR rolled out a lot of its plans yesterday, and you were listening in there. The DNR says it will first expand these testing kiosks and carcass disposal sites for hunters. How is the DNR said how these programs are going to roll out?
Well, they're really depending on public involvement and participation in order to expand these programs. Like you mentioned, the Adopt a Kiosk program and the Adopt a Dumpster program. Those were two programs that were rolled out last year, and they saw a good level of participation with the dumpsters. They had about 16 sites that were volunteers and organizations sponsored them so that they could have proper carcass disposal for deer statewide. And so they would like to see this expanded across the state, and they're looking for volunteers and organizations to sign up and sponsor these stations to help them be able to do that.
Well, what happens at these kiosks and these dumpster sites? Can you bring us to them?
Yeah, so like with the Adopt a Kiosk sites, for example, that really focuses on CWD sampling. So the idea is that people can submit a deer head along with like a portion of the neck and then fill out information like where they harvested the deer, the hunter's contact information, and submit all of that for testing at these kiosk stations. And with the Adopt a Dumpster sites, the idea is that you can dispose of the deer carcass there rather than, you know, other options like possibly leaving it on the landscape, which I don't think is common practice among hunters in the state.
So these dumpsters, they're lined and you just basically throw the deer carcass into the dumpster?
You dispose of the deer in the dumpster.
And then in several northwestern Wisconsin communities, the DNR says it's ordered hunters to submit any killed deer for CWD testing. Why did the DNR make this decision?
Yeah, this was something that came about after they saw a cluster of three positive detections in wild deer in Eau Claire County last year. And as you may know, they have increased their surveillance and sampling efforts more recently. Last year was the first year of that where they were doing increased sampling and surveillance in the West Central District, which includes about 19 counties in western Wisconsin. And they try to get enough samples so they can see the prevalence of the disease. And for that particular area, they didn't get the kind of samples, the level of sampling that they would have liked. So they're going back to round out that sampling so they can get a better idea of what's happening in that area.
So this is really about taking stock and making sure we understand what CWD is, how it is going on in Wisconsin. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, for years we had seen a lower level of surveillance. I mean, this kind of detection for CWD hasn't been done since around 2006, when they had more than 30,000 samples taken from deer that were harvested. And as little as 4 years ago, we saw sampling decrease to around 3,000. So this is an effort to get a better idea of the prevalence of the disease in wild deer.
We're talking about new steps announced by the DNR this week to address chronic wasting disease, or CWD. Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter in Superior. You can join in. What questions do you have about CWD in deer? Are you a hunter, or do you enjoy the outdoors? What do you think researchers should be doing and exploring? How should the state be addressing this neurological disease? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Danny, the DNR says testing and disposal sites will now be included on the DNR's app. It's called Hunt Wild Wisconsin. Have hunters had issues finding these sites in the past?
I don't know if hunters have had issue finding the app and some of the information. They would definitely like to see more accessibility to that information, though, through the DNR's website. Those were some of the recommendations that were announced yesterday by the Wisconsin Conservation Congress. They had worked with an advisory committee and the DNR and the State Natural Resources Board to develop some ideas of what they could do to, you know, better educate the public and release information about CWD. And putting CWD information top of the list so people can see it clearly on the website was one of them. The other thing that they were recommending was that the DNR have staff hand out brochures about the disease and also include them with every hunting license that's sold.
So they're certainly trying to spread awareness, and the state has also been monitoring CWD, as you say, for a long time, but there's still a lot of mystery about this disease. Is Wisconsin taking any new steps to learn more about it?
Yeah, as we've heard throughout this year, the Evers administration has really been focusing on research to base these decisions of how they should be managing the deer herd. Part of that is probably a little bit political because there's been pushback among Republican lawmakers and legislators after Governor Scott Walker directed agencies to craft emergency rules to help control the spread of CWD. So now there is more of a focus on getting the science first before making that decision. And that's generated a little bit of controversy among subgroups who feel like it's good to be basing decisions on science, but we also need to include regulations in that mix.
Yeah, I mean, didn't Governor Evers say that he wants to look at what other researchers around him are doing in other states before we put more budget money toward understanding CWD?
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, that was something that was mentioned at this meeting last month where the Wisconsin DNR had invited representatives of state wildlife agencies from across the Great Lakes states and even Missouri to talk about ways that they can control the spread of the disease by sharing information, leveraging resources so that they can get a better handle on it.
So is the DNR taking any new tack this fall or any new approach that might really impact CWD and contain it?
Well, this fall as part of I'm sorry, Kate, can you repeat the question?
Yeah. Do you see the DNR doing anything new and novel here as we try to contain CWD in the state?
So one of the things that they're doing that's new is that increased surveillance, for one. You know, this fall they're focusing on the northern counties in Wisconsin, which includes 18 counties, and they're going to be doing sampling there. They're also going to be doing sampling around areas that have had positive detections of the disease, whether it's been in the wild deer herd or near captive deer facilities or deer farms.
Danny, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kate.
Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter in Superior. We've been talking about the DNR's new efforts to contain the spread of CWD. Coming up, we learn how local authorities have used eminent domain to acquire land for Foxconn's manufacturing plant in southeastern Wisconsin. You can join in, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about what happened to homeowners in the village of Mount Pleasant when they sold their homes to make way for technology giant Foxconn. Wisconsin Public Radio has been investigating, talking to people. There's been across-the-board frustration. And here's that tension last year at a town hall meeting over at the village of Mount Pleasant using the powers of eminent domain.
Every day in the state of Wisconsin, we're... Properties are taken.
We're a private company.
What a bunch of assholes.
Do you live in Mount Pleasant? What changes have you seen? What concerns do you have? What are you looking forward to? What questions do you have about eminent domain? Join in 800-642-1234. Corrine Hess is a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. She co-reported a piece with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. It's titled, Owners Near Foxconn Say They Were Misled. Now Their Homes Are Gone. Corey, welcome back.
Good morning.
So we just heard that commotion from the town hall meeting. How are community members feeling right now, almost 2 years into this project?
They're pretty upset still down there. They seem to be growing more upset by the day because of what they perceive as the lack of activity happening with Foxconn.
When you say the lack of activity, what are you finding there as you travel to Mount Pleasant?
Well, you know, Foxconn did begin vertical construction in the last 2 weeks on their manufacturing building. But I think what residents and what people across the state were hoping for was more. When Foxconn was first announced 2 years ago, they had talked about, 20 million square feet of development. And now it's more, in the range of 1 million square feet at this point. So people are just frustrated by what they're seeing.
Well, let's look at some of those people you talked with, a few of those homeowners. Kathy Jensen was one of them. What was she initially told by local officials about her property?
Well, her and her husband had lived in their house. They still live there for more than 20 years. And the village told them that they needed 0.13 acres for a road project, but that the village would take their entire 3 acres. So they did not want to give that up, and they basically were ignoring letters sent to them by the village, just thinking that this would go away.
So what did the village need their property for? What was the intended use?
The intended use was the road in front of – they live on the frontage road in Racine County, and the intended use was to expand that frontage road.
Has that frontage road been expanded?
It has been expanded. It was expanded. That ended about, I'd say, a year ago. And their property is still intact. But over the course of this, the village has purchased their property.
Yeah, why was the village allowed to acquire it? They were ignoring these letters.
They did ignore the letters, but the village was able to do this through eminent domain. Wisconsin law allows municipalities to acquire property, private property, if it's done for road improvements. So they were able to do this. The Jensens really didn't understand that this was happening until it was done, and they have not moved out. So they've filed two different court cases, one in Racine County and a federal lawsuit, and both of those are pending right now.
Okay, and they're still in their home, and they're fighting this in the courts.
Yes. I mean, I should be clear, the village has put about $500,000 in a bank for the property. They didn't just take it. The Jensens have not touched the money. They don't want to do that because once they cash a check, then, they're making it final. So the money is sitting there. The village actually owns the home. The Jensens aren't leaving. So this is all up in the air right now.
We're talking with Corrine Hess. She's a reporter for WPR based in Milwaukee, and she co-reported a piece with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, talking with homeowners in the village of Mount Pleasant who sold their homes to make way for the Foxconn development. Corey, let's look a little bit closer at eminent domain and how these people in Mount Pleasant are feeling right now. What can and cannot be acquired through Wisconsin's eminent domain restrictions?
Well, like I said, the law allows municipalities the power to acquire private property using eminent domain as long as there's fair compensation and the property will be used for a public purpose. So this is typically done for road improvements or sometimes to take control of dilapidated property. And so, I mean, in the Jensen's case, they're upset because this road work was completed and their property really was not touched. And so their argument is that they want this property for Foxconn, which is a private company.
Has Foxconn made efforts at all to address these residents' concerns?
No, Foxconn has not made a statement on this. They've really been not involved in the talking about this. In the agreement 2 years ago between the village and Foxconn, the village agreed to acquire these properties for Foxconn by certain dates.
How was the village able to afford all of this acquisition?
Well, Foxconn is paying for this. It's the village is paying and then Foxconn is paying it back. And they also have created a TIF district. So there's been several accounts set up to pay for this.
You also talked with the situation with Sean and Sarah Mayer. Can you tell us what's going on with the mayor's property?
Sure. So Sean and Sarah Mayer lived on a different street, and they built their dream home. And right after they moved in, they heard about Foxconn. And several months later, they received a letter saying that their property had been rezoned to industrial instead of residential, and that the village would be taking their home through eminent domain. They were told that their road would no longer exist, so they had to go. So their home was later bulldozed along with about a half dozen other homes on the street. But that road that they were told wouldn't exist anymore is still in existence.
How are the mayors feeling today, and where did they land?
They were compensated, and they ended up moving to the Burlington area, which is on the other side of I-94.
You also talked to the Mullers, who relocated, and their former home has since been bulldozed, but they feel they were misled about what the land was to be used for. What did they tell you about the way they were informed about the eminent domain process?
Well, their story is they were living on a road for 25 years in this area, and they were given a map, and they were told, according to them, the village has disputed this, but they were told that their road was going to be expanded from 2 lanes to 4 lanes, and because of that expansion, their home was going to be taken again through eminent domain. That road is not being expanded to 4 lanes, and so their home was taken and bulldozed in June, and so they too have moved to a different part of Racine County. They're also very upset about this.
Do you feel in the homeowners you've talked with that they have some conclusion here, some closure? Do they trust their local government?
They don't have closure. I mean, in talking to the homeowners, all of them feel like they were compensated, but also misled, and they don't trust their local government at all. No.
Foxconn has gone back and forth about exactly what they'll be doing in Mount Pleasant, and even people, as you mentioned, there don't really know. Have their adjustments meant anything as far as the amount of land they'll need or the development process?
You know, we reached out a few times to the state and to Foxconn about the size and how much land they'll need and the footprint that they'll need, and they've maintained that they will still need all of this property. So I guess time will tell how much land they will need, but at this point they're saying that they will need all of this land.
Are there any lessons learned that when you talked with these homeowners that they can look back with some hindsight and say, you know what, I wish we would have done X? What did they tell you on that?
A few of the homeowners said that they wish they would have hired different attorneys. A few said that they wish they wouldn't have signed papers and they would have looked into this more. But and then others, I mean, the mayors, Sean Mayer owns a small business, and a lot of the work that he does is with local municipalities. So he said it wasn't worth the fight because he didn't want to lose his business.
And early on in the Foxconn developments, everything was going so fast, so quickly, and it seemed land acquisition was also going at a feverish pace. Have things slowed down at all?
You know, it depends on what you're looking at. It's slowed down for these homeowners because they're out of their homes. But like I said, I mean, a few weeks ago, Foxconn did begin construction on their building. So I don't know. It depends on what you're looking at.
Corinne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Corinne Hess is a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. Coming up, it's news, then seatbelt use among Wisconsin drivers is on the rise. We'll learn about the policies that have helped compliance and where there still is more work to go to get drivers to buckle up. Do you always wear a seatbelt when you drive or when you're a passenger? Do you ever feel it's okay not to wear a seatbelt? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back with your thoughts after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're looking at seatbelt use here in Wisconsin on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The good news is that 9 out of 10 Wisconsin drivers wear a seatbelt, but the bad news, some drivers still don't buckle up. Seatbelt use has hovered around 89% for the last couple years. What questions do you have about driver safety? Do you always wear a seatbelt when driving or when you're a passenger? Do you ever feel it's okay not to wear a seatbelt? Have you ever been ticketed for not wearing a seatbelt? Join in, 800-642-1234. Dave Pabst is director of the Bureau of Transportation Safety at the State Department of Transportation. Dave, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Well, take us back a decade ago. Wisconsin wanted to improve seatbelt use, so the state passed this law allowing officers to solely stop drivers for not wearing seatbelts. How low were we at a decade ago?
Well, in 2009, our seatbelt use rate was at 74%. So we had quite an improvement over the last 10 years.
And what does seatbelt use look like with today's numbers, the current numbers?
Well, the current number, we have preliminary data from an observational survey that shows we're at 90.2%. So we've pushed through the 90% for the first time in our history.
Do you know how Wisconsin stacks up across the country? Do we do as well as our neighbors?
Well, right now we're a little better than the national average. National average is around 89%. But our neighboring states like Michigan and Minnesota, they're in the mid-90s. So we have a little work to do to catch up to our neighbors.
How do you gather this data? How does our state keep track of seatbelt use?
Well, we hire the University of Wisconsin Whitewater to do seatbelt surveys for us, and they have a very strict protocol on how they do it. They have approved locations. NHTSA goes through our plan on how we do it, and then we have people with iPads out there actually taking surveys, and you know, they see a vehicle and they see if they're wearing the seatbelts or not, and they record on the iPad in real time what kind of seatbelt use they're seeing. So if the car has four people in it and they've got four seatbelts on, boom, 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 the four positions, you've got your survey for that particular vehicle. And they just do that so that you have hundreds of vehicles that have been checked with a team, a pretty large team that actually goes out throughout the state and checks for seatbelt use.
Oh, and so they're basically at intersections or places where a vehicle is stopped so they can get a good look inside the car?
That's correct. So they're strategically located to be able to observe the seatbelt use.
We're talking about seatbelt use here in Wisconsin with Dave Pabst. He's director of the Bureau of Transportation Safety at the State Department of Transportation. You can join in, 800-642-1234. What do you see in your family or your circle of friends? How do people feel about seatbelts? What do you think about seatbelts in school buses or in farm equipment? Should people be wearing them in those situations. Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Danny now in Greenfield. Hi, Danny.
Hello.
Hi there, Danny. Can you hear us?
Yep, I can hear you fine.
Yeah, what would you like to add about seatbelts?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention one thing that changed my seatbelt habits was recently I got a car that would beep incessantly until you put your seatbelt on. Same with the passenger seat. So now I almost always wear a seatbelt every single time I get in the car, whereas up until that I didn't used to do that.
Danny, thanks for the call. Dave Pabst, vehicles have become a lot more insistent that the drivers and passengers wear seatbelts with technology.
Yes, it's a wonderful thing because they do remind us, and like he said, it's incessant, and you have to wear your seatbelt. My car does the same thing, and it's like you have to wear your seatbelt. You just have to.
So why was there a push a decade ago to improve seatbelt use? Did the state see a rash of deadly crashes or one crash that hit people, you know, really hard?
Not necessarily. It's just the national push for seatbelt use. You know, when I started my career in law enforcement back in 1986, seatbelt use rate was at 26%. And we came up with in 1988, I think, or so, is when they enacted a seatbelt use law. It was secondary enforcement, and it bumped up to 55%. It's just been growing ever since. And, of course, when we went to primary enforcement, it gave us a really nice push. So it's just so important to wear your seatbelt. You know, without the seatbelt, the rest of the safety and the equipment in the vehicle doesn't do any good. So you can have a 2019 X, Y, or Z vehicle that has every bell and whistle for safety, including, you know, airbags for every position, and it won't be effective if you're not wearing your seatbelt.
Let's bring in Jack now, joining us from Manitowoc. Hi, Jack.
Hi.
What is your what's your story with seatbelts?
Well, I guess my first comment is that I've worn seatbelts regularly almost all the time. I'll occasionally not wear it if I'm just driving the car for a few blocks to get it warmed up before I park it back in the parking lot or something, which I know I shouldn't do. But I try to teach our grandkids to wear seatbelts, so I need to wear them all the time. But a few years ago, I was involved in an accident where a car facing my direction abruptly turned in front of me, and the roads were slick. I ended up hitting them head on, and I ended up with a bruised chest. Now, I'm sure I would have been injured more if I hadn't had my seatbelt on and the airbags in the car. But I'm curious whether that's something that you see often, people get an injured chest because of it, or if it was more due to my position, how I was seated in the car.
Jack, thanks for the call. Dave Pabst, are there injuries related to seatbelt use?
Sure there are, because the seatbelt is designed to spread the energy and the force of the crash across stronger parts of your body so that you don't end up, you know, getting injured more severely. Now, if Jack hadn't been wearing his seatbelt, his airbag did go off, but he would have hit that airbag really hard and it would overcome any kind of pressure that's there. And in fact, he would have had more injuries. So yes, that's sometimes how they prove post-mortem if a person is wearing a seatbelt or not, is because of the injuries caused by the strap. And I'd rather have a few bruises than them being dead or having broken bones.
Dave, what are some common reasons why people don't wear seatbelts?
That's a really good question. I don't quite understand. I grew up in a household where we were wearing seatbelts in the 60s, and my dad was a police officer and then worked for the DMV, so obviously that was kind of our culture within our family. We always wore our seatbelt. And what people do now, I mean, generally we have a problem with pickup truck drivers and young males who are, you know, 18 to 34 years old, and they tend to have an invincibility thought about their lives, and you know, nothing's going to happen to me. So how we appeal to them is we try to say, well, you really love your pickup truck, let's protect your truck. And the only way you can protect your truck is if you maintain control of it. And during evasive maneuvers or a potential crash, the way to control it is to be belted in.
Can the state do anything to address this slice of drivers, these pickup truck drivers, as you've identified?
Yeah, that's really what we're looking at. How can we get to that attitude and change that culture? Because a lot of what, you know, people in trucks, what they don't realize is trucks are more prone to rollover than other vehicles. And so not wearing your seatbelt really increases your risk of being injured in a crash. And so the odds of surviving a crash in a pickup truck increased by 80% if you just wear your seatbelt. And so how do you get that message out? And so what we're looking here at the state of Wisconsin is finding some targeted messaging and using the modern messages or means of communication with social messaging to try to get particular groups of people to buckle up. And if that's a specific ad campaign that appeals to their senses, that's what we have to do.
Let's bring in Chessie now in Madison with thoughts on this. Hi, Chessie.
Hi. Recently, a coworker and I were discussing, because we got in the back seat and he didn't buckle up, and he's like, I don't think it's a law to buckle up in the back seat. And I, based on Googling, it seemed like that was true, and I was just shocked. So I was wondering if you could confirm either way the back seat seatbelt rules.
Chessie, thanks. Dave, what happens in the back seat?
Backseat, we've changed our motto now, so, you know, buckle up every seat every time, because there is this misconception that you don't have to wear a seatbelt in the back seat. You're more likely to get hurt and or hurt somebody else in the vehicle because you are a projectile if you're not wearing your seatbelt in the rear seat. So it is a law in Wisconsin that every position has to have a seatbelt, a restraint system on. And the only exception to that is if you are in a taxi. But I would encourage anybody that's riding any form of public transportation where there is seatbelts available that you do use it, because it protects you and the driver or other occupants of the vehicle. So she's right. You have to wear your seatbelt in the back seat.
Let's go to Jimmy in Valley Junction now. Hi, Jimmy.
Morning. I was just wondering, I believe in seatbelt wear, and I try to do it all the time, but why did the motorcycle helmet law get changed so they don't have to wear helmets? It would seem to me, if it's a public safety question, they should be wearing helmets. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Jimmy, thanks. He's translating seatbelts there into motorcycles and wearing helmets.
Well, I really wish we could have the seatbelt helmet back, you know, the law back, but it's gone, and they have a strong position. It's just the will of the people. I'm sure that if they realize that wearing a helmet will save a lot of lives and motorcycles, it would, you know, people might rethink it. But it's a fairly, you know, it's an issue because motorcycles are a vulnerable road user, and when they crash, they don't have the protections you have with having that metal cocoon around you. So a helmet, gloves, heavy leather clothing such as jackets and leather pants, it's just so important for a motorcyclist to use all the gear all the time to help them survive a mishap.
Talking about seatbelt use in Wisconsin with Dave Pabst. He's the Bureau of Transportation Safety Director at the state DOT. We'll be back to this conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about seatbelt use in Wisconsin and what state officials hope to do now that there's 90% compliance. 9 out of 10 drivers buckle up. Do you? What do you see in your own family, your friends? How do people feel about seatbelts? What questions do you have about driver safety? Join in 800-642-1234. Dave Pabst is Director of the Bureau of Transportation Safety at the State Department of Transportation. Let's go back to the phones now. Chris is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. I have two of interest to me. I was riding as a passenger in the back seat of a car. I did not have my seatbelt on, and I was rear-ended by a dump truck, and the car was wrapped totally around a telephone pole. And I was, if I had been seat-belted in, I would have been wrapped around that telephone pole as well, because the spot where I was sitting is the spot that the telephone pole now occupied, and I ended up sitting on the lap of the person on the far side of the car. So at that point, I would have died if I'd had it on. However, I do have a dear friend who climbed out from the back front seat of the car where everybody was seatbelted, and she climbed into the back to take care of a baby that she refused to take out of the car seat and hand to the mother in the front. She herself, just as she climbed to the back seat, they were hit by a drunk driver, and she was ejected through the front windscreen. She survived, and luckily the baby, which had been refused to be taken out of the car seat, also survived.
Wow.
And everybody else too.
Those are harrowing stories, Chris. Dave, what do you make of them?
Well, it's amazing, and I'm so glad Chris is here with us to share that story, because, you know, stories like that are out there, and you know, there are what we'll call anomalies in seatbelt use, and I would say that that's one chance in a million that this happened, and thank goodness it worked out for Chris. But the data certainly shows that rear seatbelt use is really important. In the rear seat, you don't have the same protections as you do in the front seat. You don't have all the airbags that you have in the front. And you become a missile, like I said earlier, if you're not buckled in. Now, that was kind of a fluke crash that she experienced with a dump truck in a pole or a tree. And thank goodness she survived it. But for the most part, it's just so dangerous not to wear your seatbelt in the rear. You just need to wear it, because chances are it will save your life.
Patrick in Richland Center couldn't stay with us, but he wants to know if it's required to wear seatbelts for ATVs. What are the rules with ATVs?
Well, that's more of a question for the DNR. It's kind of out of my wheelhouse,
okay.
But I would think if any safety equipment is on a vehicle of any type, that it's to your advantage to wear it. So I'm not sure about the laws when you're operating them on the highway, but certainly the smart thing to do is always wear seatbelts if it's so equipped.
Let's bring in Sarah now in Madison. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning.
I recently have seen a number of articles about how crash test dummies are modeled after the male skeletal frame, usually about 5'10", 160, and that car seat design and seatbelt design has then developed with those crash tests and men's frames in mind. And I'm wondering, as someone who's always uncomfortable in my car, if you guys have read any research about how car companies are thinking about adapting seats and seat belts for different body types and for women as well as men.
Sarah, thanks for that. You know, she mentioned 5'10", 160, Dave, and not all people are that structure.
You're right. And, you know, they try to make it so one size fits all. And I'm not aware of any studies, not that they aren't out there, but personally, I'm not aware of any studies for the differences in the way we're built. But I do know one of the questions that comes up often is, well, I'm pregnant, should I be wearing my seatbelt? And of course, the answer is you're always supposed to wear your seatbelt. You got to protect two lives here. And it's just so important to wear it properly. So it's coming across your chest and then way down low across your hips, where that force can be transferred during a crash, so you don't injure the baby and you protect the person wearing it. So unfortunately, I don't know of any studies right now in that area.
We got an email from Chase who says, you know, a lot of kids are back to school this week, and we're wondering if seatbelts are required, as they're required for family cars, why not be required for school buses?
Right. Well, school buses are a really unique vehicle. They are designed for safety from the ground up. They have a heavy steel roll cage that runs the entire length. Every few, you know, widths of the window is another roll bar of steel. They're designed with what's called compartmentalization. So you're sitting in the seat, and if you're involved in a crash, your body will go forward, but the seat back in front of you is designed to crush and move forward and absorb that energy. Now, with the cameras that they mount in buses now, we are starting to see how during other style of crashes, you know, the most common crash is a front end or a rear end crash in a school bus. So those are very well protecting the children during those crashes. But it's when the bus rolls over that we do see the need for seat belts. And I know the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, they're working on changing the law so that school buses are able to be equipped with seat belts, and they're kind of leaving it up to the states to determine what's right for each state.
Talking with Dave Papps, Director of the Bureau of Transportation Safety at the State Department of Transportation. Let's bring in Tammy now in Onalaska with a question. Hi, Tammy.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question regarding I know a lot of families with a large number of kids, and vehicles are very expensive now. What's the proper mode when you have more people than the car is, quote-unquote, designed for?
Tammy, thanks. Dave, what about the number of passengers in a vehicle when you exceed the number of seats?
Well, then you're exceeding the safety ability of the vehicle, but there's no law prohibiting it. So my advice is always to put the most vulnerable people secured properly. But then you have to make this decision. Well, who is the one that's going to get hurt when we crash? And also having the loose bodies out there in there, they can kill people that are properly restrained. So my advice is to, you know, take another vehicle, somehow find more appropriate transportation. It's just so dangerous. It's not illegal. So if you have six places in your vehicle, but you've got seven people in there, as long as this equipment that is there is being used, and the younger children that are required by law to be buckled in and in car seats are in car seats, you're fine.
Well, the state's latest seatbelt figures were announced in Wisconsin Dells recently at the Governor's Conference on Highway Safety. You were there. What were some of your takeaways from the Governor's Conference?
Well, I think it's an exciting time in Wisconsin because we have a governor who supports highway safety, and it's a great time for us to try to move this needle forward, especially in seatbelt use and speeding and OWI and drug driving. And our takeaway is that Wisconsin is in a good position to improve, and we have to just double down on what works and then change some of the tactics that we're using to get that message across to those, you know, young male drivers in their pickup trucks that they need to wear their seatbelts.
How much of a problem is texting and driving these days?
Well, it's a serious problem because you can look for yourself when you're driving, and if you stop at a stop sign or even just going down the road, you see people on their phones all the time. It's a serious problem. You know, we're doing a really good job with drunk driving, but now we've got to deal with distracted driving. And the problem with distraction is when you're using your phone, whether you're talking on the phone, texting illegally, or doing whatever on it, as soon as you put it down, you're still distracted cognitively for 21 to 23 seconds. It takes time to switch from one task to another. So it's dangerous for you to sit at a stoplight, look at your phone, because now you're getting out of the awareness around you, and it's just really dangerous. And you don't get it fully back until after 20-some seconds.
Well, Dave, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dave Papst is Director of the Bureau of Transportation Safety at the State Department of Transportation. Just ahead, we take an in-depth look at college affordability and access to financial aid with a researcher who studies education costs. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.